We got an official notification of Victor's transfer and a brief note about Pendleton. Colonel King, from the 422nd, came by and said a prayer with the God Squad. The colonel said he had written to Pendleton's widow. I don't know why I kept reading the newspaper about what's going on over here. I could just look around, but then I'd only see a small piece of it. What I'm seeing is confusing. Marla put it best. You go out and you see people shopping, she said. Women buying onions and bread or people having coffee. Then down the street somebody gets blown up. Jesus, it's weird. It was weird, weird and unnerving. Somebody buying onions, somebody getting their fingers blown off, somebody dying. Hey, Jonesy, how you doing? I called across the tent. I'm good, man, he said. He was lying on his bunk humming to himself. How you doing? You want to hear something crazy? I asked. Go ahead. I was wondering about Victor's monkey, I said. Whether he should have kept it. Isn't that stupid? I mean, to think that a monkey was going to make any kind of difference? At the service for Pendleton I was wondering if God made a difference, Jonesy said. I guess if I'm wondering about God, you can wonder about the monkey. The whole place is in an uproar. We got word that nobody is to leave the green zone in groups of less than 7 and with only up armored vehicles. Marla told Captain Coles to go find out what was happening and he got pissed because he didn't like Marla's lack of respect. Okay, sir, don't go and find out, Marla said. But they're not going to tell me anything because I'm not an officer. Coles shook his head but he went. Jonesy had a toothache but Miller wouldn't give him any painkillers. She told him to go and see the dentist. Captain Miller, when I'm not stupid, Jonesy said. If I go to the dentist he might need to drill my tooth or pull the sucker, which will put me in more pain than I'm in now. And he might save you some pain down the road, Miller said. Did you ever think of that? That's all right, Captain. Jonesy lay back on his bunk. I'll just lay here and suffer because no one cares about how I feel, anyway. We all knew that Miller would give him some painkillers in the end but Elektra would go with it. With all her bad-mouthing, she was becoming the mother of the CA squads. I think she enjoyed it too. Coles came back with the news. It wasn't good. A Marine unit found a bunch of civilians dead in a garage, Coles said. They think Americans killed them? Evans asked. They don't know who killed them, Coles said. But they found them with their hands bound behind their backs and all five were shot in the back of the head. And they were all Sunnis, so something is going down that doesn't smell right. Were they working with us? Miller asked. Maybe they were killed because they were being looked on as traitors or something. From what I gathered the thinking is that they were killed by one of the Kala death squads, Coles said. We had all heard about the death squads. There was some sort of vague connection between them and the people we were pushing toward the leadership of the new Iraq. Before the invasion the Sunnis had been in power and the Shiites had been pushed around pretty good. Saddam was SUNM and had put all his peeps in the key positions. Now that Saddam was out and we had put the Shiites in power, there was a sudden explosion of mysterious killings. Why aren't we trying to stop these death squads? I asked Coles. Maybe we are. Coles answered. Your guess is as good as mine. The whole thing sucked big time. Every day we were hearing about stuff that had nothing to do with democracy or freedom. There were stories about looting, about some Iraqis being put out of their homes so that others, the ones we were backing, could move in, and stories about Iraqis becoming suddenly rich and nobody knowing why. Now the talk was about death squads. Coles went on to say that some of the victims had been tortured. There was a whole battle going on around us that we didn't have any grip on, that we really didn't know about. Some of the construction guys, engineers, started talking about bodies that had been found at the power plants north of Baghdad. Those youth were just executed, one of them said. It had to be other Iraqis. There wasn't anyone else around. I thought about a basketball game I had played against Lane High School. Lane had the better team but we had the lead. The coach signaled for a timeout and we gathered around the bench and he started yelling at me because I had kept looking at the scoreboard. The game is on the floor. He had screamed. Yeah, That was true, but the win was on the scoreboard. I knew. When the time ran out, whoever had the most points was the winner. I didn't know if we were winning here in Iraq or not. If we just talked about dead people, about bodies lying in the streets, then we were winning easy. But somehow it wasn't about who was doing the most killing. Jonesy had said it best. The only dying that means anything is your own, he had said. For everybody else, you just shakes your head and keep on keeping on. So how did we know if we were winning or not? And if we weren't winning anything, what was the dying for? Coles came over to me on Saturday night. He looked exhausted. I thought the war was finally getting to him. So, Bertie, what do you think about this war? He asked. I don't think I like war, I said. It teaches you things, though, he said. What it's taught me is that I love my wife and family more than I do, and a lot more than I ever told them. Doesn't that suck? I mean, having a wife and family and not getting around to telling them how much you love them. Doesn't that just suck? Do you know it now? It doesn't suck, I said. Captain Cole shrugged, patted my shoulder, and headed off to bed. I thought of what Jonesy had said about keeping score. I knew there were stories about the Iraqi police we were training, that they were mostly Shiites more than willing to kill Sunnis anywhere in Baghdad. The thing was that killing was taking on a different meaning to me. To take a human life had always been so heavy a deal. It had always meant that some terrible thing had happened, some horrible wrong had occurred that brought people to the far ends of sanity. But now I was willing to kill because I was afraid of being killed, willing to kill people I had never met, had never argued with, and who, perhaps, had never wanted to hurt me. But I was afraid and so I would kill. And now, when I was hearing about the Sunnis being killed, or the bombs going off in the marketplace, the only thing I could think of was that I was so glad it wasn't me lying in the streets of Baghdad, or Fallujah or Mosul. I was glad that it was not my blood being cleaned off the streets or getting swept up on the roads outside of the city. Images flicked through my mind. Pendleton's body awkwardly twisted in death, the pictures of his girl still in his pocket against his cooling skin. The parts of the Marine on the busy street. Muslim women in black, their hands over their mouths as if they were holding in the screams that would reveal their souls. The old grandmother wailing over the body of the boy. The amazing thing was the randomness of the dying. If you were American, your picture might be in some daily newspaper. If you died on a slow news day, your mother's grief might be captured in a 30-second spot. If you were Iraqi, there would be no mention of your dying unless you could be called an insurgent. The only dying that means anything is your own, Jonesy had said. 2 feet 1 3. Amen to that. We stayed in the green zone for the next 2 weeks. All right with me. I didn't want to leave. I took care of a lot of necessary business. I cleaned my M16, all of my uniforms, and even my boots. I also took out a subscription to The Source, mostly to keep up with the music scene. The only work we did for the entire time was unload a truckload of gifts from the Free Will Baptist Church in Martinsburg, West Virginia. We had a big debate over whether salami was pork or beef, decided it must have been pork, and kept all the salamis, the cookies, and the candy bars for ourselves. We gave out the canned foods, toys, powdered milk, and toothpaste to the Iraqis. A tribal leader named Hamid Faisal al-Sadat complained that the coalition was not protecting his people, and that a number of young men from his area had been killed when they entered Fallujah. A PSYOP major from the 3RD was supposed to talk to him, take his complaint, and see if he could establish a liaison. We were going along as backup. Security? I asked. They're beginning to respect what we've been doing, Cole said. The major will be in charge and we'll just stand around and smile at Al-Sada's people. Captain Miller will see if they need any medical attention we can supply. And what is that supposed to mean, Captain Coles? Miller had her mall vest and her game face on. We can't give them routine first aid because we're afraid we're going to be flooded with their sick. We can't give them medical supplies unless it's cleared through 3,500 channels because we don't want them giving those supplies to the insurgents. And we can't refer them to their hospitals because half of them aren't operative. So what do we do? Hold their hands and tell them to take an aspirin? Would you like to shoot me, Captain? Coles asked. I mean, if that would make you feel better. It might, Miller said. She was right. Sometimes we could see what was needed, but we just weren't allowed to do it. A lot of the guys from the 422nd were talking about sending home for more supplies for the Iraqis. That was really strange to me. Here we were fighting a war, or at least cleaning up after the fighting, and sending home to our families and friends for supplies for the enemy. When I saw an entire truckload of notebooks and school supplies that had come in from Forest City, Arkansas, I was impressed. Americans did care about the rest of the world. A lot. Third Squad was going to Fallujah with us. The plan was that we would talk to the Sheikh and then spend the night guarding a nearby antiquity site. I was just glad it wasn't Second Squad, because as much as I liked Darcy and thought that Evans was at least okay, I was still pissed at Sergeant Harris for his messing around with Jonesy. I want to remind you guys that my birthday is August 12th, so start saving your money for presents, Marla said. She had copped some sandwiches from the unit kitchen and was opening each one to see what they were. Yo, that's not sanitary, Jonesy mentioned. Shut up or you won't get one, Marla answered. Marla took the sandwich that looked like turkey and cheese. I snatched the ham and cheese, and Jonesy got the pastrami. That left one sandwich that looked like it could have been tuna fish, but Marla sniffed it and so did Jonesy and they couldn't tell. Smell it, Bertie. I sniffed it. It stunk. It smells like fancy feast, I said. Cat food. Marla closed it carefully, and then wrote Captain Coles on the package. Sometimes, when the weather was clear and it wasn't so hot that you thought you were baking, Iraq seemed like the most beautiful place in the world. It seemed huge, with wide open spaces that stretched into forever. When you got away from the rivers, it was mostly desert, especially as you went north from Baghdad. You could ride for mile after endless mile and then come across three camels and a donkey going about their business as if there wasn't any war or any occupation. Guys would stop to take photos and the Iraqis would wave or just stop and look at us the way we were stopping to look at them. The cities were all crowded, huddled together around whatever plumbing and electrical resources they had, but the people seemed to know how to live their lives. They took things easy, spending a lot of time with their tea or coffee or, if they were men, with the hookahs. When they were calm, they were very calm. When they got excited, it was hard to tell if they were angry or just looking that way. One minute an Iraqi would be screaming at the top of his lungs or a woman would be falling down with emotion, and the next they would just calm down and continue taking care of their business. You couldn't really tell who was important in the towns or villages because there wasn't much difference in the way people dressed. In a formal meeting, the Iraqis would always wear native dress and I didn't know one unit from the other. Darcy had painted some Iraqi people and scenes using watercolors. They were good and I thought about asking her for one. We met up with a PSYOP major and six infantrymen, two of whom were black. They were in a truck with a screen around it. It's probably a communications vehicle, Jonesy said as we looked at it from Miss Molly. They're using the whole thing as an antenna. That seemed on the money and we got into a conversation about all the equipment we had and how cool it would be to steal it and take it home in civilian life. I thought I would like to have the night vision equipment. Jonesy wanted the Kevlar protection gear. I just want the squad gun and the Humvee, Marla said. If I rode into the Walmart parking lot with that bad boy, I could park anywhere I damn well felt like it. We got to the village and the infantry guys took up casual positions around the cluster of buildings we were visiting. They were supposed to look as if they were just hanging out. That was funny because the Iraqis ran around in long shirts and sandals and we were looking like spacemen with helmets, goggles, vests, and weapons. But the Iraqi kids loved to see us. Coles was riding with the PSYOP major and they came over. Major Scott was young, maybe 30. And 6'4 to 6'5. He looked us over and said he was glad to have us aboard. You people are doing a wonderful job over here, he said. Everybody's talking about it. The more friends you guys make, the fewer people we have to kill, and the fewer who will want to kill us. I never remembered smells before. I would recognize a familiar smell, fried onions or morning coffee, but in the Humvee I remembered one. It was the smell of blood in the cab when we were trying to get Pendleton out. I tried to think of something else to release the tension. It wasn't a crazy kind of tension but a low-level feeling that I was learning to live with 24/7. I kept my eyes on my side of the road, eyeballing every cart or old pickup that we passed as if it might suddenly turn into something deadly. When we got to the meeting place, it turned out to be a huge tent, 20-some feet across and 30 deep. It was dotted deep red that looked good against the reddish sand. There were smaller tents, black and brown tents, around the large one. We thought we would have to take up positions the way the infantry guys did, but Captain Coles came out and said that both the 1st and 3rd Squad could come inside and have dinner with the Sheik. Corbin, from 3rd Squad, had to stay with our vehicles, which were parked together. Marla gave him Captain Coles' sandwich. "We'll bring you something from inside," I said. "Maybe some camel ribs, or whatever they're having." "I'm down with camel ribs," Corbin said. "And see if they got any potato salad." There was a 6-foot gate around the tent and the Iraqis had guys standing near it. Casually dressed, they looked to be 18 or 19 years old, but with mustaches and AK-47s. We smiled at them as we went in and they smiled back. They weren't wearing uniforms, but the weapons told me all I needed to know. The table was placed in the middle of the tent. There was a rug on the floor, and from the edges I could see there was matting under the rug. The Sheikh was in his 50s, a smallish man with neat, gray hair. He wore a traditional Iraqi garment, the long flowing jalaba with the embroidered front that richer men wore, but I could easily imagine him in a carefully tailored suit. He sat at the head of the ornate table and four of his people, two on either side of the table, sat with an empty chair between them. Major Scott and Captain Cole sat at the other end and the guys from our CA unit sat in the open chairs. Major Scott spoke Arabic but Ahmed, who had come along, sat close to him to help translate. We were given a bowl of fresh fruit and raw vegetables, served by young women. None of the Iraqi men seemed to take notice of Marla, but the women did, and I saw one of them smiling. At first the talk was all polite and nice with Major Scott and Captain Coles talking about how beautiful Iraq was and the Sheikh talking about what a wonderful country America was. I was surprised how good his English was. I asked myself, what did Adam know of paradise? Said the Sheikh, who told us to call him Hamid. He woke up one day and found himself in the Holy Garden and he had never known anything else. That's what I think has happened to America. You are young people. What have you known but the paradise of peace and security and wealth? It makes your thinking different from the thinking of my people. I think most people want the same things from life, Major Scott said. We want freedom, we want love, and we want a chance to go to heaven when the time comes. He didn't sound sincere. So, you like my country? Al Saud continued. I'd love to come back and take a vacation here one day, Scott said. After things are stabilized, of course. And that's where I think we, you and I, as equals, can make a contribution. Cooperation. The Sheikh spoke to his people in Arabic and they all nodded politely. Sometimes, the Sheikh said, it's better to abandon modern words. When a word falls out of the mouth today, it can mean anything. It takes years and sometimes generations for words to be chiseled in history. So, when you talk to me about cooperation between our countries, I have to ask myself, Hamid, what does a man who has 1,000 jet planes mean when he says cooperation? The conversation was getting interesting and going faster than I thought it would. It means I will do as much for you, to make your life better, as I can, and in return, you will do the same for me, Major Scott said. In America we say one hand washes the other. Have you eaten food from the Middle East before? The Sheikh asked, changing the subject. No, I can't say that I have, Scott said. Any of your people have eaten food from the Middle East? Scott looked at us and we all shook our heads no. Well, then I'm pleased that I've introduced you to the world's best food. Hamid smiled broadly. Where have you been in the United States, sir? Marla asked. Washington. New York. California. Once I was in Scottsdale, Arizona. You have a beautiful country. And beautiful people. Bertie here is from New York, Marla said. Hamid spoke to the others in Arabic and they turned and looked at me. One reached out and said something in Arabic as he shook my hand. I felt stupid just smiling and nodding. He could have been calling me a jerk. The thing I love most about America is the weather. Here it is either hot or it is raining. My cousin went to live in Chicago for 6 months, Hamid said. In 6 weeks he wanted to come back. Because it was so cold. He said he watched people standing in the cold looking at the holiday lights and he could see their breath freezing. Well, that's Chicago for you, Major Scott said. But let me ask you, sir, and I don't mean to be rude, but are you still making up your mind about cooperating with the coalition forces? Making up my mind? The Sheikh turned and spoke in Arabic to nobody in particular and a girl came in, from the next room. Hamid spoke to her briefly and she left quickly. I got the impression that she was just outside the door waiting for him to speak to her. When you speak of cooperating, the Sheikh spoke slowly, weighing his words, I think you mean helping each other in a common cause. Two strong men can lift a heavy rock. Exactly. Major Scott hadn't been eating much, and now put down his fork. The rest of us had been scarfing down the food big time and it was great. I was concentrating on eating slower than Jonesy because the Iraqis had hardly touched their plates. In this operation, and you know we call it Operation Iraqi Freedom, Major Scott said, we are in what we call the security and stabilization phase. And there are people out there who don't want that stabilization to work. I'm sure you know that as well, sir, as I do. We can provide additional security for your people, and with that security comes stabilization as we turn over all the operations to the people of Iraq, but to do that we need to free up some of our men from searching for the major weapons systems that we are pretty sure exist. And what I'm saying, the Sheikh had held up his hand for Major Scott to stop. You mean the weapons of mass destruction? I do, Major Scott replied. Go on, sir. If you help us find these weapons, we will be able to divert men away from that operation to providing security for your people. Major, may I tell you a little secret? The Sheikh asked. Of course. Sir, the war you began is over, the Sheikh said. That war you won. It was not beautiful in the end, there were no violins, no birds singing in the sky, but it is over. What is going on now is a completely different war. In this war you merely stand on the side and hold the coats. This war is not about you or America. You are trying to stabilize a government in Baghdad. But there are others who are creating, how do the English put it? A shadow government. And which government in the end will rule the Middle East is a new war. Look around you. It is my people who are being killed in the streets of Baghdad and Fallujah. Yes, yes, I know. They kill one or two Americans to make it look good, is all. When the insurgents shoot at us, we think they're meaning to kill us, Major Scott said. But I can appreciate your concerns about your own people and we're certainly trying to stabilize things here. Do you really think that we have the problems that your papers are reporting? Hamid asked. Do you think that people who have lived together for more years than your country has been in existence suddenly find it impossible? That the hatred has grown so quickly between Sunnis and Shiites that we must shoot each other and bomb each other? No, my friend. Everyone knows that eventually you will miss the warmth of your own bed, the blue eyes of your own wives, and then you will go home. Then who will rule Iraq? It won't be Saddam Hussein, Major Scott said. The Sheikh closed his eyes and bowed his head toward Scott. But for the rest of the meal, there was very little said except by Major Scott, who kept insisting that the coalition forces would provide more security if the local people helped us find hidden weapons. The woman who had come in before returned with two men who served an entire second course. One of the Iraqi men saw me smile and smiled at me. The dinner ended with the Sheikh saying that he would do his best and Scott saying that was all that he wanted. Sir, what we can accomplish together, the coalition forces along with the goodwill of the Iraqi people, will astound the world, Major Scott said as we stood outside the door. We're going to have some of our people work with yours tonight at the hospital. We'll assess the needs there and do what we can. We mounted up and started toward the hospital. Captain Coles rode with the Major until it was time for us to split from them, and then he came over to First Squad. So what did you think? I asked Coles. I think Major Scott was right in the way he handled it, Coles said. He had to pin the shakedown into actually doing something. The different factions over here all want our goodwill, but they don't want to actually do anything to get it. I think the Sheik is just one of them uptight dudes, Jonesy said. You know the type, bomb them once or twice and they get a chip on their shoulder. I didn't know what weapons Major Scott was looking for. The army hadn't found any big stash of chemical weapons, although they had to be somewhere because they had used them against the Kurds. There were Marines in Fallujah and they were on edge big time. A Marine captain met up with Coles and shook his head slowly back and forth as Coles explained that we were going to assess the needs at the hospital. Fallujah is the body bag capital of the region, the captain said. Don't spend any more time there than you have to. And don't trust anybody. They killed some contractors here and burned their bodies. Keep that image in your head. How do you keep your guys safe? Coles asked. By killing everything that ain't smiling, and half of everything that is, the Marine captain answered. Captain Coles' mouth tightened as he nodded. We got to the hospital and it looked like crap. There was barbed wire around it and Iraqi guards. We rolled up and a guy came out and directed us toward what looked like an ambulance entrance. I was nervous as Jonesy drove in. Hamid called and said you were coming, the man said. Let me tell you my situation. You are Americans. I am Iraqi. Just talking to you could get me killed. I have to send my people out and say that I am getting supplies from you that will save Iraqi lives. Otherwise I will be attacked for cooperating with you. You give us a list of supplies you need, Miller said, and we'll try to see that you get them. We can't guarantee anything, but we'll try, sir. Talib al-Janabi, the man said. Do you know anything about hospitals? I'm a physician's assistant, Captain Miller said. I have a degree in biology and enough military training to qualify me for most medical positions. Then you don't need a list, Talib said. We have next to nothing here. We are down to washing bandages. Anything that you can get for us will be appreciated. We heard mortar fire. Coles called the Marines and found that there was fighting in a nearby cemetery. A Marine officer told us to stay put and he would try to get us an escort out of the city in a few hours. Marla found a bathroom and we took turns, all except for Captain Miller. I'm going to look the place over with this guy, she said, indicating a heavy man in a nearly white coat. I'd like to get an idea of how bad it is away from the green zone. You're not allowed to treat Iraqis, Captain Cole said. I've got a few rolls of clean bandages and some antibiotics, Miller said. I don't think it's going to make a major difference in the war. And you know the patients here aren't the enemy? Coles asked. I don't have a good answer for you, Captain, Miller said. But my gut feeling is that you don't let people die if you can help it. You got a better answer? He didn't. None of us did. Through an open window we got a great view of an enormous moon hanging over the squared roofs of the city. Silver and white against the darkening sky, it seemed bigger and more important than anything below it. Some radio messages told us about insurgents in the area. We were told to stay on alert. We talked about baseball and tennis and then, as we always did, what we were going to do when we got home. I hadn't known that Sergeant Love from 3rd Squad was married. He seemed like a nice guy, but maybe a career soldier. You got kids? I asked him. 5, he answered with a smile. Join the National Guard in Baltimore for the extra money. I remembered Pendleton and asked him if he had pictures of his kids. Back in my locker, he said. I don't want them being captured. That's a little stupid, right? I don't think so, I said. Maybe you'll show them to me when we get back to the base. Sure. Night came in a hurry. The moon lit up the streets and sent eerie shadows across the frosted windows. The night air in Fallujah was fresher than what we were accustomed to in Baghdad and I felt myself relaxing. We could still hear sporadic small arms fire outside. I thought I recognized the staccato cough of a machine gun and occasionally what could have been a grenade. Bertie, you look nervous, Marla said. I was half lying, half sitting on a dark couch that looked as if it might have been a place where patients waited to be seen. When the rest of the world is nervous, I said, you can bet that I'm still cool. Oh, you sound so brave. Marla said. Now Jonesy over there is fast asleep, probably dreaming about the Blues joint he's going to open. I looked over to where Jonesy was sprawled out. His M16 across his body looked like a guitar. Very cool. So, what were you telling me about some foster family you were with? I asked Marla. My bios, the folks that bored me, if they were ever really together, broke up when I was 2 or 3, she said. I don't remember. All I know is that I was going from foster home to foster home. Once in a while I would be in a group home. I guess I wasn't cute enough to be adopted. I thought that a lot of white couples wanted to adopt kids, I said. Yeah, I guess. Marla had her helmet off and was spinning it upside down on the tile floor. But my folks weren't dead and they wouldn't consent to me being adopted. I think my dad wanted to get a few bucks from me or something. I don't know. Anyway, I knocked around in a bunch of places. Some were good and some weren't. Then I ended up in juvenile court for shoplifting, and this black family took me and kept me out of juvie detention. I was with them for a little over a year, giving them a hard time. They had a kid of their own with cerebral palsy and really wanted a companion for her. It was all good with them. At least I didn't have to fight her husband off. He was okay. Then it was time for me to either go to college or get a job. So I joined the army. You going to stay in? No, I'm stronger now. I'll probably get out and go to college, she said. I'd like to be a teacher if they let me bring my M16 to school. Keep the kiddie poos in line. We talked a while longer and Coles came over and told us that we were going to be in the hospital for the night. I had figured that much already. It was nearly 5:30 when Jonesy woke me to say that we were mounting up. I'm glad I'm not married to you as loud as you snore, he said. Captain Coles said that we were going to start out on our own but go through a part of town that was controlled by the Marines. They'll know we're coming and look out for us, he said. We got ready and were waiting for Miller, who we figured was making another survey of the place. I started thinking about the guys the Iraqis had caught and hanged in Fallujah and immediately had to pee again. I told Jonesy, who said I was the pongest black man he had ever met. The bathroom we were using was down the hall and off to the right. I started walking a little faster because I really had to go. I was just about to reach for the doorknob when the door opened and an Iraqi started backing out. He was pulling something. I jumped back against the far wall. Another Iraqi had his hand over Captain Miller's mouth and was pulling her head back. The guy facing me yelled something and the one nearest me turned. He had an AK-47 slung over his shoulder and let Miller go as he reached for it. I pointed my piece at him and pulled the trigger. Nothing. Safety. I pulled the safety off and shot a burst into his face. He spun away from me, his hands going to his face as he went down. Captain Miller was on her knees and the other guy was fumbling in his jacket. I tried to say something. I wanted to say don't move. I wanted to tell him that it was over. Nothing came out. I pointed the muzzle at his chest and he reached for it, grabbing the barrel and pushing it up. Frantically I jerked it away from him and pointed it at him again. I don't remember shooting again, or any sound the weapon made. All I remembered is the way the top of his head exploded and the way his hands, fingers spread wide apart, went to the side of his face. Captain Miller was shaking. Her hands were beating flat against her chest and she was sucking in air noisily. I thought she had been shot or was having a heart attack. You okay? I asked. She looked up at me, then at the two guys on the bathroom floor. Neither of them was moving. She pulled her pants up and buckled them. She was saying something, but either I couldn't hear her or no words were coming out. The rest of the crew had heard the gunfire. Later I learned they thought it was outside. Miller was stunned. She kept hitting the front of her Kevlar against the tiled wall. Are you all right? I asked.
No. No.
No. She screamed. She screamed. She cried. She rocked back and forth. She moaned. With all the garbage that's going on. With all the disgusting garbage that's going on. How can they? How can they? She was crying again. I put my hand on her shoulder. Miller turned to me. You stopped them from raping me, she said, but you didn't stop them from ripping up what was left of my soul. I'm sorry, I said. I don't care about sorry anymore, she said. I just don't care about sorry any freaking more. Outside the air was clear and crisp, already warm. The sky was slowly turning from a quiet pre-dawn gray to the brilliance of morning. In the distance the bright reddish gold of the Iraqi sunrise began to spread over the horizon. Dark silhouettes brightened into sprawling fields and square squat structures. The foul smell of the Euphrates River mixed with the sweet odors rising from the sands along its banks, adding texture to the rising sun, like a chorus of strings backing up a sad saxophone. Our crew was going back to Baghdad, back to the base. It was just another sunrise over the city that had seen sunrises from long before man wrote history. But here, on this bright morning, I rode for the first time as someone who had killed. All the times before that, I had fired my weapon into the darkness, or at some fleeting figure in the distance, I could say that maybe I had missed, that maybe it was not my bullets that hit them. No more. I wanted to be away from Fallujah, away from Iraq. I wanted to be alone in the dark with my grief. I wanted to mourn for myself. The Marines took us through Fallujah and halfway to Baghdad. There we met a patrol from the 3rd and tailed them back to the bubble. We didn't talk about the incident on the way back. When I got out of Miss Molly and headed toward the tent, Captain Miller stopped me. Thanks, Bertie, she said. Thank you. Later Marla came in and sat with me. You need to be with somebody. Let it be me, she said. We had a birthday party for Jean Darcy, who turned 21. The guys in the mess hall came up with a dynamite cake and enough ice cream to feed the entire army. Darcy's parents and friends from Oak Park, Illinois, had made all the arrangements and there were at least 50 presents, cards, and thank you notes for her service to the country. It blew Darcy away. She sat in the middle of the floor, all her birthday stuff around her, and cried and cried. We were all hugging her and kissing on her and half of us were crying too. It was crazy cool. Instead of keeping the presents, Darcy handed them out to us still wrapped in the boxes and so we all got a few odd things. I got skin lotion and Jonesy got a sponge on a rope to wash his back. Y'all trying to say I stink so bad I got to tie the soap down? Jonesy asked. The party lasted until way past midnight with guys slurping down cokes and ice cream until they got sick. I was queasy in the morning when somebody started a whistle going for roll call. We fell out, half awake, half dressed, and half pissed that we had to make roll call at all. The trek to the mess hall was just reflex. I wasn't in a mood for breakfast or even the hot coffee sitting in front of me. After breakfast I went to the main tent and lay on my bunk. Colonel Rose came by at 11 o'clock with calls and the women. He waited until everybody had been called to attention and then gave us the at-ease command with a grin as if he wasn't all into the gung-ho crap. Boys, I got some good news for you, he said. Anybody here want to hear it? I looked over at calls and he was rolling his eyes up. Crap. I'd love to hear some good news this fine morning, sir. Harris, sucking up as usual. I'm sending the first, 2nd, and 3rd squads to Asalia for a briefing, Rose said. A little change of pace. See something different in this part of the world. Major Sessions will give you the details. But I'll tell you this much. When they called down from CENTCOM and specifically asked for men from our unit, I was proud as hell. Proud as hell. It means we're taking care of business. And we're going to continue taking care of business. You'll be moving out at 1800 hours this evening. God bless you all. The moment Rose and Coles left, we started asking around to see if anyone knew where we were being sent. Wherever you're going, we're not going with you, Marla said. He specifically said men. He thinks he's paying us a compliment by including us with the men, Darcy said. But wherever it is, it can't be anything good. Did you see Coles? He was definitely pissed. What is it with you guys? O'Crowley, one of the construction guys, came over and sat on Corbin's cot. You're supposed to be CAs, but you're getting into firefights, going on combat missions, getting hit real hard. How come they're giving you the dirty end of the stick all the time? We ain't nothing but some bait, Jonesy said. They put us out there to smile and see who's shooting at us. Then when they pop enough caps in our rear ends, they change the rules of freaking engagement so the infantry can start shooting back. I think you're right, Captain Miller said. We're supposed to be helping our side win the peace, and we don't even know what we mean by peace. Maybe you don't know what you mean by peace, Jonesy said. What this little brown boy means is sitting home making sweet love to his guitar. It ain't got nothing to do with this foul mess over here. We're serving a purpose, I think. Corbin hardly ever spoke. It could be that we just don't see their purpose. And I think the place we're going to, Asala or Asalia, something like that, is where President Bush spoke. You think he's there now? Marla asked. Because I seriously need to talk to that man about getting the porta potties air conditioned. Sessions came in next. She looked tired, older than she had just a few weeks before. She didn't say anything, just motioned for us to come to her. The first three squads and medical are going to Asalia for a briefing and then going on a special mission, she said. I don't know what the briefing is going to be about, or the mission. Neither does Captain Coles, but he's going with you. Yo, ma'am, from your tone of voice you don't seem too happy with this business, I said. Sometimes I feel as if we're being asked to do a lot, she answered. But I know that if we weren't doing a good job they wouldn't be asking. So, the army had a way of throwing crap at you in waves, and this just seemed like another wave. We got into a serious group funk for about 20 minutes, but then the word got around about where we were going. Then guys started showing up saying that it was our end or heaven. They're building everything down there, an infantry dude with a bad case of acne and terminal dandruff said. It's in Qatar and there's no shooting going on, at all. My friend went down there for 4 days and didn't want to come back. They've got a swimming pool, lounges, beer, everything you can think about. How come he was only there for 4 days? Jonesy asked. That's what it's about, Dandruff Dan answered. It's wind down city for guys in combat. 4 days of chill and thrill in Kuwait and then back to Bang Bang City. Combat? That didn't sound good. Marla went over to headquarters company and begged a guy to let her send an email home. She came back ready to blow somebody away. The creep said no. She said something about all the area being jammed for security. I don't believe him. I asked him to check my emails and he did, and he didn't have any problems. I should go back and shoot him. Emails are coming through? Corbin asked. Yeah, I got one from Victor, Marla said. He wants us to take care of Yusarin until he gets back. We were told to turn in our weapons to supply and to put most of our gear into our bags until we returned. Just take enough for 4 days' change of underwear, Cole said. And take any civvies you have. My one pair of jeans smelled musty and the two shirts were wrinkled, but I packed them, anyway. On the way to the bus, Miller was cursing up a storm. She was really good at it, too. What you thinking, Bertie? Jonesy was next to me in the crowded C3. We were hip to hip with our legs stretched out and touching in the center of the plane. I'm thinking that we might be getting reassigned, I said. But if the women are going, then we probably won't be getting reassigned to the infantry. What you thinking? That sounds good to me, Jonesy said. I'll think the same thing because I promised my mama I wouldn't get into no out-and-out combat. It took an hour and a half from wheels up to touchdown in Doha, Qatar. It felt good to get out of the bus and not feel the weight of a vest full of ammunition. The ride to Asalia was short and it was still daylight when we reached the camp. We were taken to our quarters. Yo, Bertie, I've been here before, Jonesy said. This is hog heaven. You know, just before they kill the hogs they bring them out of the pen, let them wallow in the mud a while, then rub their backs. Then? I had to ask. Then they get their choice, bacon and eggs or Hop and John. There were people to greet us, to check us in, and to tell us where everything was. A girly-looking lieutenant told us that we had the next day off. I got up at 8:30 in the morning. We had been given printouts with the layout of the camp, but what I saw right away made me feel good. There were guys just hanging out and relaxing. On the front lawn of our building, there were women in robes and bathing suits sitting in lounge chairs and a volleyball game going on. I thought it was great. I bet the gladiators had a place just like this that they could cool out in before they fought the lions, Captain Miller said when I met her coming out of one of the coffee shops with a huge cup of orange juice in one hand and coffee in the other. We found some lounge chairs near the pool and stretched out. Marla and Evans found us and flopped down too. Did you see that we're allowed so much beer per day? Marla asked. Yeah, but I don't drink beer, I said. That's another thing you need to work on, Bertie, she came back. What I was supposed to do was to chill, and I realized I was working on it way too hard. I kept reaching for the weapon I had left back in Baghdad. Some men from the 101st Airborne were dressed in desert camouflage uniforms, but everybody else had managed to scrape together a few civvy units. Sometimes it was only shorts and a t-shirt, but it was civvy. The food was good, but not much better than in the bubble. The difference was that you could buy as much junk food as you wanted and everybody was lining up to get at it. I wanted to see if Miller, who was all into science and health, would go for it too. She did. Darcy slept most of the first day. Love found a religious group and had Bible study. The rest of us played pool or just hung out in the rec room and watched one of the four big televisions. A heavy sergeant from Kansas City, his name Tapri Dongan, told me that the place had originally been set up for the media. They've got every kind of transmission device you want right here, he said. Studios, radar connections, the works. They got any amps? Jonesy asked. They have a whole professional setup for visiting entertainment, Dongan said. They even have guitars and a few horns. Once in a while somebody comes in who can play them. Jonesy checked everything out and I figured he would try a hookup, but he said he was too tired. If I seen two courts and a big-bodied mama walking down the street between them, I'd have to wait until I got online before I could send them a shout-out, he said. This war is wearing my black butt down to a freckled nub. Yo, Bertie, did I tell you I had freckles on my butt? Jonesy's freckles were not what I needed to hear about. I thought about hitting on Marla. She was looking really good in a beige sweater she had brought with her and some dark slacks. I asked her how she was doing. I'm sitting here wondering what Victor is going to do with the rest of his life, she said. How many guys you know out there in the world kicking it with two fingers on one hand? What are you thinking about? She asked. I knew I didn't want to answer her. I shrugged and looked away and she asked me again. Yo, Marla, I'm trying not to think about the war, I said. You just want to relax here? She said. I can understand that. No, that's not it, I said. If I think about the war enough, if I think about Pendleton and Victor and some of the other things I've seen over here, it might become part of me. You know what I mean? I'm afraid of that. I've always thought of life as being precious and wonderful and all about the great things you were going to do with it. I don't want the images of body parts lying in the streets in my head. I don't want to think about shooting somebody and seeing their life twitch and jerk away from them. Maybe it's all a part of me already. I don't know. Look, I'm trembling. My hand is actually trembling. Jesus, Marla, it's me I'm scared of. Does that make any sense? It makes sense, Bertie, Marla said. It makes sense. The second night at Isalia went badly with me banging around the bed and waking up 100 times trying to figure out where I was. I dreamt of being in a firefight. Crap. I dreamt of shooting people. It was like I was shooting and couldn't figure out who the enemy was and just kept on firing. Who the hell was I if I was dreaming about shooting people? Everybody watched the news in the morning. It was as if we were in a game without rules and we had to watch the scoreboard to see how we were doing. We watched the president say how he had accomplished the primary mission and were well into the last phase. A reporter asked him when the troops would be coming home and he said they would be home when the time was right to bring them home. Most of the guys cheered that. Somebody noticed it was Sunday and Marla and Barbara went to early mass. Jonesy and I went to a music store and bought a copy of the Survivor CD and a CD player. There were two machines. One for $80 and one for $19. I wanted to pull our money and get the $80 job, but Jonesy was all against it. Go cheap, he said. That way when things go wrong you know why. Don't you ever buy good stuff? Only in wine, he said. In wine I stick with Petrus Clandestinus. I don't know anything about wine, I said. You probably know it by its street name, Jonesy said. Sneaky Pete. At 1500 hours we were rounded up and told that the CAs had a formation at 0800 in the morning. I wondered if there were other CAs besides us and Ongan said no. In the afternoon Captain Miller bought a map and we gathered around as she showed us where Qatar was. Marla asked her where she had been and she said she had been hanging in the officers' club. Trying to get a fix on this war, she said. Trying to see if we're really kicking as much butt as we say we are. Are we? Jonesy asked. A lot of people are dying, Miller said. Is that the same thing? Monday morning formation. Macho casual. There was a table set up in the lounge with coffee, donuts, Danish, and OJ. A thin lieutenant colonel with a thousand lines in his face spread a tablecloth over one of the pool tables. In the middle of the table he put a small orange, two figs, and a handful of raisins. My name is Lieutenant Colonel John Kelly. I'm a career soldier, and my father before me was a career soldier. Folks, there's not much on this table to eat, he said. When you give it to one person, you have a chance to make a friend. When you divide it between two people, you're liable to make two enemies. That's what we're facing here in the Middle East. There's so little to go around and so many people who need both food and spiritual substance that no matter what contribution we make we're going to create more enemies than friends. You've been here a while and you've seen it in the streets and in the countryside, so you know what I'm talking about. He went on, but he was right. We knew what he was talking about. There wasn't one war going on in Iraq, there were a dozen. The invasion had made a power vacuum and different groups were rushing in to fill it. There were Shiites and Sunnis and tribal groups and Kurds, and political parties. Our guys, our army and our Marines, were in the middle of it. Basically, I'm saying that we believe in democracy, and in the American way of life, and we are trying to export that to the world. We've done a fine job of it so far, the colonel went on. In 1776 we were the world's only true democracy. Now most of the world's leadership had followed our example. I don't want to sound utopian, but if we can bring 1776 to the Middle East we can change the world. You young people can take an important step in that direction. You can show us the way. That's what I'm asking of you, that's what America is asking of you. Thank you. The lieutenant colonel snapped to attention. Ten Hut. Captain Cole stood and saluted. Kelly snapped off a salute, nodded, and left. From the back of the room another officer, this time a major, came forward. He was Asian, short, and very muscular. Everything about him was spit and polish. Troops, we're going to be sending you on a mission that's a little out of the ordinary. The major spoke slowly, deliberately. Your unit has been in Iraq for some months now and you know that the enemy, and by the enemy I mean anyone who is trying to do us harm, plays on the edge of the playing field. Sometimes they change the rules and that gives them a marked advantage. We're going to be selecting a team from among you to work with some other players in the area to complete a mission. You're going to be playing on the enemy's turf, on the edge of the field, and you're going to play with whatever rules work to complete the job. If you're successful, you will save lives. American lives, yes, but also Iraqi lives. Let me change that to other lives as well. Okay. From now on what you do and where you go will be on a need-to-know basis. When you finish the mission there will be very few people in the world who will know what you have accomplished, but the army will know, the President of the United States will know, and most important, you will know. I don't see this operation as being very risky. You should be able to move in, do what has to be done, without shots being fired. If there is a need to have shots fired, You can rest assured that your security detail will be amazingly proficient at doing just that. My read is that it won't be necessary. Finally, I want to tell you why you are being asked to do this. Your unit has dealt very efficiently with the civilian population. You've built bridges and relationships that the 422ND, which is now taking over the bulk of the civil affairs function, will be using. In other words, you get the job done. That's all we want. Every time you people make a friend, help a sick child, you create the possibility that we'll get some little piece of information or cooperation which will help us win the minds and hearts we need to prevail. At the end of this mission, your entire unit will be reassigned. Many of you will be returning to the States to train other CA Special Ops. Most of you will have interesting choices. Thank you. The Major snapped off a salute and he was gone. We headed back to the rec room. Captain Coles, what was that about? Miller asked. I have no idea, Coles answered. Okay, here's where the blues come in, Jonesy said. When you come home and call out, hey, sweetie. And your sweetie ain't there but you see a note on the table next to a bottle of wine, right away you know ain't nothing good is in that note. This here R&R is like that bottle of wine and they sent two officers to deliver the note and neither of them told us what the sucker was all about. What I say is, put a dollar in the jukebox and push J7 four times because the blues is definitely coming down. I was excited about the whole thing. Kelly and the Asian officer were both being goony but they were letting us know they were serious about the importance of the mission. What bothers me about this bad boy is that crap about it not being risky, Marla said. If it's not risky, why doesn't he get his little bit on the stick and do it himself? I think it's because we're good, I said. You read some bad crap in the papers about what's going on over here and you don't read about us or the 422ND or any of the CA operations. I feel some bad mojo working, Jonesy said. Some bad mojo. I don't feel it, Marla said. Our unit is being given a lot of jerk details but we're getting it done. This might be a little hush-hush but I bet we work it. Sessions called us together that evening and told us that what she called the insertion team had been picked. Ma'am, is this insertion team about sex? Marla asked. Sessions acted as if she didn't hear her. Then she announced the team. It was going to be the first and second squads. Everyone else is excused from this meeting. At first the others didn't know what that meant, but slowly they got it and stood up and left. I felt excited. My stomach was jumping and I was nervous, but I was also excited. Where are we going? Barbara always seemed to have a hair coming down into her face that needed pushing up and she was brushing it back as she spoke. Outside of Baghdad?